Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
All right. Well, Dr. Perlman, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you.
So I wanted to, first ask you the traditional opening question, which is, how did you become interested in this project?
So it's the typical academic answer. It derived from my dissertation. And originally, I was sort of interested in looking at how illness in Japan in the modern period, so around the early 20th century, was perceived. I came across an amazing book by William Johnston, got a name drop there, The Modern Epidemic, about tuberculosis. And I was completely fascinated and blown away. And I started wondering, if there is this huge epidemic going on in Japan, how was it actually dealt with? How was it utilized? If the government is not really doing anything to address it, was anyone else? And so it kind of got me down this rabbit hole, looking at medical missionaries and evangelists and just this tiny little lacuna that Dr. Johnston, in his otherwise really comprehensive book, didn't have a chance to cover. So I like to think of my work as an analog or a corollary to his, but that might be giving me a lot of credit.
Well, no, that's really interesting. Of course, I saw some of that influence from Johnston's book. Obviously, it is sort of the canonical work. But I thought, you open up a lot of interesting avenues, in part by this question of, how is this epidemic being used, right? And who is benefiting, or that's a horrible way to say it, but who's benefiting from it, right?
No, it's absolutely correct.
Yeah. So I want to get into that in the individual chapters. But before we do that, I want to look at some stuff from your introduction and your conclusions. And of course, your conclusion is qui bono, right? Who benefits, which, of course, is absolutely the question that we're asking here. But I want to jump back to the beginning and ask you first a couple of questions just to get us squared away here. So you open up with this really fascinating line. This is the story in large measure of something that did not happen. And as you say, the government chose basically not to treat TB as a public health crisis, which left it to the sort of civil society, private sphere. And then you ask that question about who benefits, right? And I want to talk about this in more detail. But first, let's set the stage. When does this all go down? I'm sorry, let me just throw out a bunch of questions for you and you can just go right ahead. Yeah. So first, when does this all go down? And then when TB is relegated to the private sphere, you show in your book that it presents an opportunity for Christian evangelical groups for what you call moral entrepreneurship. And you also see that same kind of moral entrepreneurship mirrored on the part of the Japanese government. And you ask this really interesting question, should this moral enterprise be condemned as little more than a farce? And your answer, yes and no, is quite striking, right? And you also write that the moral entrepreneurs are using people as political and soteriological currency so that the lives of the patients of tuberculosis are worth less than their souls. So can you, you know, set the scene for us and then square this sort of circle on the tension between your criticism about, you know, using the TB patients and the sort of yes-no answer you give to that question?
Yeah, I would love to. So Jonathan is correct. Tuberculosis is a modern epidemic. Obviously, it's an endemic disease. It has predated humans. It will probably outlast us. But when we're looking at the epidemic in Japan, we are looking at an epidemic that is concomitant with the processes of modernization along Euro-American industrial lines. So urbanization, the building of factories, the movement from the countryside into cities, often into slums, into dormitories, to work in the factories. So it's a post-Meiji restoration disease. And for me personally, I'm looking in this book primarily between the 1880s and 1920s for two reasons. The first is because this modernization effort and the industrialization upon which modernization is really built by the Japanese government is taking place during this time and is seen to be quite successful during this period. But it's also when evangelists are first able to proselytize with really varying degrees of success in the Japanese nation. Christianity had been outlawed until 1873. And so while there were certainly foreigners who identified as Christians and identified as evangelists, they were there under various other auspices. But by the 1880s, both of these movements had really been taken by the Japanese government and by the evangelists in full force, to say nothing of the fact that tuberculosis was pretty rampant. And I think the interesting thing, particularly when looking at the Meiji government, even into the Taisho government that follows, is the fact that this is a government that's really, you know, on the forefront of medical research, on bacteriology, on epidemiology, in terms of so many other epidemics and diseases. The government is really quite forceful in its enacting of laws and public health measures, but tuberculosis seems to just fall into the cracks. And that was one of the things that interested me, you know, why is this happening? And then how do these Christian evangelists come in to fill in those gaps? Because they see this as an opportunity to be useful, not just to the Japanese subjects, but particularly to their government. Because it was a time when, you know, Christianity has only just become legalized. And you want to, as an evangelist, prove your mettle and your worth to your potential converts. And ideally, if you can get converts at the upper echelons of society, at least according to these evangelists, that's so great because this is the kind of influence they wield. So what I look at in the relationship between Christian evangelists and the Japanese government is this sort of moral entrepreneurship, wherein each party, whether it's the Japanese government or these foreign evangelical organizations, essentially paint themselves as like the moral party vis-a-vis the Japanese public when they relate to each other, that they are the ones who are caring for the populace the most, that they are working for the best interest of the Japanese people. But it ends up getting really complex because it's not just a bifurcation. You also have a lot of these American Protestant non-denominational evangelical groups, so the Salvation Army, the YMCA, sort of maneuvering with and against each other, again, trying to deal in conversion rates and presenting themselves as the true sort of Christians in Japan. The problem is, when it comes down to looking at the victims of the tuberculosis epidemic, you have individuals who are essentially unable to have any sort of agency. And to a certain extent, it makes sense. I mean, there wasn't suffrage. Japanese subjects were subjects. Certainly the victims of tuberculosis that I talk about the most, women, wouldn't get suffrage until after, until during the occupation of Japan. But with the Christian evangelists, there was this need to present the number of converts in a very positive light back to the boards at home, whether that's the American YMCA board in the States or the Salvation Army board, in order to garner donations from back in the home country. So you have people who are working out of their own interests. And sometimes what ends up happening is that the victims of tuberculosis are kind of left by the wayside, or they're pawns in this game. And at best, sometimes they're seen as a collective rather than a series of individuals, which makes them just sort of this block of currency rather than people. There are a couple issues with this that you touched on in your question. That one, well, there wasn't a cure for tuberculosis at this time, so what could anyone do? And that's true. And certainly a number of the medical missionaries and evangelists who went to Japan are doing so out of what they believe is a true mission and calling, and they do want to help. Similarly, a number of politicians are not unaware of the plight, but as politicians are often want to do, sometimes their political power is maybe more important. So those caveats aside, what we see happening in certain cases of work among evangelists, particularly evangelists who do not feel beholden to boards back in the United States, is that they're sort of able to overcome this moral entrepreneurship or this moral maneuvering. And they are able to offer care for the victims of tuberculosis, even if that care doesn't offer any sort of panacea. It just offers some form of acceptance. And it might be paternalistic acceptance, but considering the environment and the sort of mythopoeia surrounding tuberculosis, not just in Japan, but worldwide, sometimes that was enough. Sometimes it was just enough to be considered for a short period as a human rather than as a victim of a disease, or rather than as a soul that could be said to have converted, you know, and who could no longer speak because they were dead or they were not living anymore. So that's why I kind of answer that as a yes and no.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that, because I think it's one of the most to me, sort of philosophically difficult questions that you're tackling in the book. But to get into one more sort of really practical question before we jump into the chapters, I wanted to ask you sort of more generally about tuberculosis, right? Because TB is a scourge in really all of the early industrializing countries. As you point out, there's no cure, and treatments are basically palliative. And as a historian of Japan myself, I mean, we talk about TB a lot, but I've always sort of wondered myself, I mean, was it worse in Japan? And if so, how and why? And I ask this in part because you're, I think indirectly at least, arguing that the government's decision not to tackle TB was a factor in prolonging and worsening the epidemic. But I guess I'm also sort of curious, you know, how and why it got so bad so quickly to begin with, that, you know, that decision made it worse.
Yeah. So I think that, again, it's an epidemic that is common in sort of the industrialization process. And so certainly, you know, England had its fair share of rampant tuberculosis beginning in the 18th century with the Industrial Revolution. Similarly, in America, in France, in Germany. The difference is, and it was, you know, horrible in all of these countries, but all of these experiences with the epidemic happened prior to the height of the Japanese epidemic. In England, in the early 19th century, I believe like 1 in 4 deaths were due to tuberculosis. But from 1913 to 1940, with, you know, pauses for world wars, the disease was on the decline, a significant decline, and was a notifiable disease to the government. And these sort of examples were ones that the Japanese government were certainly aware of, had the option of pursuing and following. And they, members of the government certainly did toy with it, but it was seen as being ultimately against the interests of both the government and the nation. So whether or not it was worse in Japan, it was certainly made worse by the fact that the government felt that it was a cost of modernization. Because it was an epidemic that was primarily for quite some time limited to societies neglected, namely young, impoverished, often rural or from rural areas, female textile workers. The epidemic and its victims could be and often were written off as a sacrifice of the modernization process. That Japan's modernization was built in the textile factories, and the textile factories were populated by these female workers. And this was sort of a necessary cost of creating a modern nation. The idea was, you know, if soldiers go to the front lines to give their lives for the nation, to serve the emperor, and women can't fulfill that role, well, here's what they can do. And, you know, it was kind of easy to continue to dismiss this as long as it went on. The connections between the government and industry in Japan were quite tight, to say the least. And this was profitable. And I mean, we've unfortunately seen a very sad analog to it, you know, nowadays with with our own current pandemic and the economy, that there are sacrifices that governments are willing to make and people die in the process.
Yeah, I'm glad that you both put that in very stark terms. And the comparison with the army, I think, is particularly interesting, right? But also the stark comparison with our own current situation. I know it's always difficult for historians of past tragedies to become suddenly relevant. and I'm sure this is not an entirely pleasurable experience for you, but obviously it's one of the things I was thinking about as, you know, preparing for the interview. And I'm glad that you were able to touch on that. So I want to jump into the chapters, right, and talk about first, as you do, these young women that we've been sort of touching on throughout. So chapter one, Dead Shriveled Trees, Factory Girls in Meiji and Taisho Japan, gives us an overview of the lives of these young women. And so can you tell us a little bit about the conditions of their lives? And also I want you to, if you could, to circle back around a little bit to the introduction in explaining your idea that the, you know, something that you know, which is that public and elite perceptions of these factory girls being sort of immoral factored into the government's decision to allow TB care to be privatized, because that's something we didn't get a chance to talk about in the introduction, in addition to everything else, right?
Yeah. So I mentioned that, you know, modernization in Japan is built in the textiles factories, excuse me. The top three industries in Japan in 1926 were raw silk, cotton spinning, and cotton fabrics. And these had always been, since really the Tokugawa era, since before the modernization effort, the proto-modernization, had been considered the realm of women. By around the turn of the century, female workers were performing 60 to upwards of 90% of all textile work. So when we talk about both the textile factories, but also the modernization, the early efforts of modernization for Japan, we're really talking about these women and oftentimes girls. And they are recruited specifically from rural villages, often promised education or opportunities that they lack in their villages, often money to help support their families. They're sold this idea that this is not just notable work, but work that will benefit them in addition to the nation, that this is going to help them, their families. And it certainly helps the nation. What ends up happening is that they get to these factories where they're living in dormitories, as is often the case with, you know, sort of modernizing efforts. There are very little legislation in terms of factory conditions. The government passes a factory law in 1911. They don't have to enact it for another 5 years, and even then, it's pretty spotty. So we have women and often children working 12-plus hour shifts, standing at looms, at machines. They get breaks divided up through the day, 15 minutes in the morning, half an hour at lunch, another 15 minutes later on. But these breaks, they have to remain standing. There's nowhere to sit. They work through the night. They are provided with meals, but obviously this is a capitalist enterprise, so we're looking at cost-cutting measures. So the nutrition is quite poor. They work 10 days in a row, before they get a day off. Rarely are they allowed to leave the dormitory during the day off. The dorms are packed with 23 to 45 women and girls in about a 15 by 24 square foot space. There's no heat. They share bedding. They sort of have these rotating shifts so that if you have someone who is infirmed and they are leaving to go work on the factory floor, that's your bedding. Bathing occurs 3 to 4 days. Hundreds of women get 20 tubs of water. They aren't reheated in between. The factory floor itself ends up being overheated. The dorms are freezing. None of this is particularly salubrious for these women. But again, it's seen as being a cost of modernization. There's a lot of women who are willing to take their places at the spindles, at the machines. You know, even though a third of all Japanese manufacturing by 1930 are textile workers, and of those, you know, 90% are indeed female, that's still just 2.5% of the archipelago's total. So out of all of the remaining 97.5%, you can find other girls to replace ones who die at work or are get so infirm that they are sent back to their village. I think one of my favorite is not the right word, but I think one of the most notable quotes was from a political economist, Dorothy J. Orchard, in 1929, who noted when studying the textile mills in Japan that the individual worker is cheap. And she's right. They were literally worth less than the product they produced. So on the one hand, you have these women whose lives are being considered very flippantly, not only in Japan, but worldwide. And then add on to this, even among labor organizers, these sort of stigmas and stereotypes that the factories were rampant, you know, nests of lesbianism or prostitution, that these are just somehow lesser women because they are not seen as the good wife, wise mother sort of standard. These are just kind of your subaltern cast off. So of course we're going to tar them with whatever brush we can, in whatever way we can to kind of justify the fact that we are ignoring them and letting them die.
Yeah, and I think if you ever decide to do a talk on the subject, not particularly salubrious would be a lovely title. it's interesting because, you know, I was just, you know, I was thinking, you know, in making this transition between chapters one and chapter two, that, well, you've, you know, now you've introduced our protagonists. And then I realized that's not actually the case, right? Because the women are not the protagonists of anything in a way. I mean, they ought to be, but in fact, they're the subjects. In some ways, they're almost the antagonists of the whole story. And the real protagonist, the first one, comes along in chapter two, and that's TB itself. But then, you know, you also have the protagonists of the story, who are the scientists and governing elites, and of course, the evangelicals, who are, you know, come along later in your story. But I want to jump into chapter two. So in this chapter, The Snow White Shawl, Tuberculosis in Meiji and Taisho Japan, you sketch out the sort of modern histories of TB, both in the West and in Japan. And as you've already begun to do, you've noted some remarkable similarities. And to the extent that we haven't, you know, to the degree that we haven't covered, you know, everything, paint that picture for us here. And in particular, it'd be great if you could reference the tension between the TB patient as object of erotic desire and moral reprobation. I guess maybe there isn't necessarily attention depending on your personal proclivities, but that's something that was particularly interesting.
Yeah, I think that this is really one of the fascinating parts, and it's something that obviously in America and Europe, Susan Sontag talks a lot about, and in Japan, Karatani Kojin and Fukuda Mahito. But the strange thing is the weird mythopoeia that surrounds tuberculosis as a disease is strikingly similar between the European conceptions and the Japanese conceptions, even before you have a real sort of dialogue between these locations. This sort of, so tuberculosis has this weird, seemingly psychological, physiological connection, where we see the idea that there is just a surfeiting of emotion and desire and passion that can't be expressed outwardly in the correct way. And that kind of creates this weird predisposition towards tuberculosis. And you see this in the stigmas about mental illness. You see it in even stigmas about genetics that people attribute to tuberculosis. But I mean, tuberculosis is sort of the most romantic of all of the epidemics, which is crazy. But you know, in the 19th century, we have Keats and Chopin and Byron and all of this sort of people who ooze sentimentality, just eroticizing this disease. And it becomes this weird feminine stereotype, that this declination of life is a weird marker of sensuality in chasteness. Physically, the tubercular beauty was seen as becoming more wan, becoming more pale, becoming more lithe, as like her body was literally consuming itself. And you get this sort of romantic notion of subverting concepts of beauty, the healthy beauty, the, you know, someone who could bear children. But then, as it's often the case, it kind of defines beauty. So you just need to look at, you know, La Traviata or La Boheme, that this is just like, oh God, there's so much passion that, yeah, I can sing an aria, but I can't frickin' breathe. So you have this strange kind of connection. And you see it in Japan too, where you have these heroines, Tokutomi Uroka's Hototogisu, Namiko. She's just such a passionate young woman, and she pines for her husband, and it just eats her up inside because they can't be together, and oh, tragedy. Until, you know, consumption literally consumes her. At the same time, especially among men, and again, you see it in Europe and America, and you see it in Japan, you have this sort of moral reprobate as bad boy. And that happens more with men than with women. That there is something about the victim that they are responsible for their disease. Not because they, you know, weren't social distancing or, you know, being healthy in that way, but that there is this some sort of mental illness at the root of it. So you look at like Franz Kafka writing about his tuberculosis and saying essentially, well, I deserved it because why wouldn't I get it? This seems obvious. In the same way, Kasai Zenzo, a famous author of many short shishosetsu, these I novels. In one of them, he writes his hero, who is basically him, writes that, like, well, it's weird if I didn't get tuberculosis. Like, if you can vent your fantasies, your passions, you're not going to get it. But I have just turned in on myself and I just suffer, and the angst has manifested itself as tuberculosis. And all of this is, of course, insane. There's nothing sexy, whether it's in the bad boy vein or the you know, erotic beauty of, like, coughing up bits of your lung. It's a horrible, horrible way to die. But because it is a disease that can be dormant for quite some time, because it is a disease that doesn't necessarily have a, how can I put this, a scatological aspect, like, unlike cholera, it's hard to make cholera seem really sexy or dysentery, because it, you know, there's a effluvia that is hard to hide. But for some reason, humanity seems to think there's something really sexy about, you know, coughing up a little bit of blood, even though your breath is gonna stink after that. You know, it makes your lips red, and if you're already pale from fighting off this disease, they're seen as something very enticing about that to a certain population. But of course, the reality is very different. It's a horrific way to die.
Yeah, and I think this was the eroticization of it has always struck me as, you know, particularly bizarre. But the idea of sort of wasting away in consumption as a kind of memento mori, right? Like this idea, right, that somehow the process of dying reminds you of the passions of life. I mean, that I can kind of wrap my head around, but yes, I guess, the idea that coughing up a lung would be sexy just has never,
right,
it's not my personal taste.
If you get into the nitty gritty of it, it tends, yeah, to lose its appeal. Just as, right, a sort of idealized version, then yes.
Yeah, I think many things do.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on that note, let's move on to chapter 3. I think we may be getting stuck in our own effluvia here, yeah, so no, let's move on. So chapter 3 is, it introduces a scientist, Kitasato Shibasaburo, who is sort of key to the scientific battle being waged against the disease in Japan. And so here in this chapter, The Enemy of Mankind, The Struggle Against Tuberculosis, you look at Kitasato, who's both a government scientist and an independent researcher, and his efforts both to battle the disease and his unsuccessful efforts to convince the government to do so. So how did he approach TB, and why was it not successful? Both as, I mean, scientifically that makes sense, but sort of in terms of his ability to convince the government to get on board.
So Kitasato is probably one of my most interesting sort of touchstones. He's a fascinating man in his own right, particularly given the fight against tuberculosis. He is really concurrent with the period that I'm looking at. He graduates from the medical school of Tokyo Imperial University, what would become University of Tokyo, in 1884. And the government sends him to Germany. Most of Japan's scientific and particularly medical elite were sent to study in Germany. And he works under the tutelage of Robert Koch, who is famous for isolating the bacillus that causes tuberculosis. And the two become not just mentor and mentee, but really great friends. And in the beginning, Kitasato, under the auspices of the Meiji government, has a number of very strong allies. Nagayo Sensei, who sort of sparks this sort of modern medicine within the Meiji era. Mori Ogai, who is not just an author, but also a physician. And so Kita Sato is doing really great work with Robert Koch at his laboratory, but also independent. He's isolating the tetanus bacillus. He was working on anthrax. He ends up working on the bubonic plague. And he becomes one of, if not the sort of most famous of Japan's bacteriologists. But even though he's seeing all of these successes, the government needs him to come back home and begin doing research in Japan and assisting the nation in that way. And Kita Sato is resistant. Both he and Robert Koch are working on tuberculin, which they hope is going to be a cure for tuberculosis. It isn't, as it turns out. But in doing so, he manages to annoy a number of people in his government by sort of resisting the pull back to Japan. It looks like, and indeed he was, pursuing loyalty to Robert Koch over his senpai in Japan. When he finally can sort of avoid, or no longer avoid, leaving Germany, and he's brought back in 1892, the government sort of understands that he's going to join up in the lab at Tokyo Imperial University, and he does not want to be essentially a government puppet. He feels that he is his own man. He feels that he is entitled to control his own fate, what he's researching, what he's doing, what he wants to study. He's able to sort of continue to work independently. His friends and backers launch a media campaign, and they allow the Japanese Diet to help him fund an independent laboratory. Again, for another two decades, he's kind of able to stave off the impending grasp of the government. But he's managed to make some very powerful enemies in politics, and he doesn't seem to care. He's not a very politic individual. He's quick to make enemies. He thinks, you know, he should be able to pursue the science that he wants to pursue and not be beholden to anyone else. And so even while he is highly regarded in Japan and particularly worldwide, the government sort of bristles at his independent streak. And the problem is that because he has managed to antagonize a number of elite officials, both within the government and sort of in that coterie surrounding the government, he ends up losing the influence, the funding, and potentially the attention of the government that tuberculosis, which you continue to work on, merited.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and so this is, I think, very interesting, both for me personally, I'll get to that in a second, but because Kitasato provides such an interesting contrast to the American evangelicals who are ultimately successful in taking over the sort of social, if not medical, treatment of tuberculosis, because he is so completely politically inept.
Yeah.
And the reason it was sort of personally interesting to me is I have, passing familiarity with him as the mentor of a scientist that I had been working on recently, someone who had worked with Kitasato at his Institute for the Study of Infectious Diseases. And so he's tremendously influential as, a scientist, both within Japan and beyond, as you say. But ultimately, his, I think you said, bristly, maybe that was the word you used, personality. I'm sorry.
I said, that's a good one. That's a good word.
Yeah. I mean, his bristly personality is, he's very much the sort of porcupine's dilemma. The closer he gets to you, the more it hurts. And it ends up in this kind of failure to be able to rally support for his cause. And so, of course, he presents this interesting contrast to the evangelicals, but also to the person that you deal with in chapter four, our first sort of politician. So this is Okuma Shigenobu. And in this chapter, justifying the liabilities which had been incurred, political strife over tuberculosis, you look at Okuma, who is, as you say, a very compelling figure. And you describe his guiding moral philosophy as utilitarianism. Could actually got through that without stumbling. You also point out that he had a sort of creative, flexible relationship with the truth, something that as a parent, I certainly understand. Also that he was the perfect moral entrepreneur. So what does all that mean? And how does it shape his approach, which is obviously very different than Kitasato's to TB? What are the value judgments and equations that are running through his head? And how does that shape the larger responses of Japanese officialdom? I'm particularly interested in your judgment, and I'm quoting you here, that regardless of his true feelings about Christianity, Okuma was an unabashed devotee of medical missions. And that seems to me that's sort of the heart of what you're trying to get to here in this chapter.
Yeah, so he really does offer a very fascinating, Okuma does, counterpoint to Kitasato, because he's so hard to pin down for so many people, whereas Kitasato does not have a poker face at all. It's very clear where his loyalties lie. He does not want to play any sort of politicking game. Okuma is a politician par excellence. So when I say utilitarianism, I have to add caveats, in part because my husband is a philosopher and he's like, what does that mean? Okuma is a politician who, like a number of individuals in the Genro, in the sort of main generation of Meiji politicians, didn't feel the need to justify their actions the way political parties would have to later. There wasn't really checks on legislation. You could pursue politics without a hindrance of legitimation, at least not to the subjects or to the populace. Andrew Barshe talks about how the Meiji mission of Fukoku Kyohei, the rich country, strong army, was pursued by the government and as concomitant with modernization as both the pursuit of a family state, this idea of kazukukuka, where the emperor is the head of the family, the paterfamilias, but also with kanson minpi, this exalt the sort of politicians and deride the populace. And Okuma is kind of part of that. He does what it is he feels is necessary to do without being beholden to constituents or political parties or, even foreigners. But he doesn't necessarily stick with any one kind of party line or one raison d'etre. He's very much interested in what will benefit not just him, but what he feels about the Japanese nation. And one of the reasons why I picked him was because not only is he sort of paints himself as an outsider, but he's an outsider who becomes prime minister twice, once during the Meiji era for a short amount of time, albeit, but also during the Taisho era for significantly longer. And even when he's not being prime minister, he's served as minister of finance, minister of foreign affairs, minister of agriculture and commerce. So he's been involved in the government despite kind of painting himself as an outsider. So what do I mean when I say he's an outsider? Well, like many of the early politicians slash all, in Meiji, he's a former samurai. But unlike a number of them, he's not from the former provinces of Satsuma or Choshu. He's from Hizen, which already he's kind of outside of this clique, but it allows him to kind of float without having these associations from these locales. And he's always able to serve various factions fairly well, not without, pissing off people. Certainly, there was an assassination attempt, so that probably is a testament to the fact that he does piss off people. But he was seen as being sort of the consummate statesman without any sort of group affiliation. He wasn't beholden to party, ideology, creed. He just wanted to be sort of accepted by specific individuals from whom he desired something: money, influence, power. And so he would tell them what they wanted to hear without, again, having to stick to any one party line. And I think that is quite useful for a moral entrepreneur, because moral entrepreneurship is about flexibility. It's about constantly maneuvering. And Okuma was amazing at maneuvering. He's not a Christian. Early on, he's very clear about his antipathy to the religion itself, but he's often noted as being appreciative of the work of Christians and to them appreciative of the ethos of Christianity. So he can appear very friendly to foreign evangelists, to foreign journalists. He's a really charismatic guy, unlike Kitasato. But he's also really canny and very savvy. So an anecdote that I like to tell is in 1905, Hannah Riddell, who is a British evangelist who was working on trying to assist the victims of Hansen's disease in Japan, or leprosy. And she sends out a call for funding. And Okuma is happy to receive this. He assures her that he supports her work wholeheartedly. And so he gives her cherry and maple trees to line the grounds of her sanatorium. And yeah, he's known for having a green thumb, but I'm pretty sure that Ms. Riddell was not looking for an arboreal donation. You know, she asks again for money, and then he kind of goes radio silent. So he's able to say, well, yes, of course I support this mission. I've you know, given something of myself, but he's doing this without actually putting anything on the line. And I think that is really indicative of how he works with these foreign evangelical organizations. And a lot of them are really happy to hear it, because they then can go back to their American boards and say, well, we have the backing of the prime minister, even though all he's doing is paying lip service and maybe giving a tree.
Yeah, the Arbor Day quality to his commitment to the problem is really, it's fascinating, because you have this, you know, as you say, lip service to support, but then what's actually happening is that the problem is really being passed off to someone else. So he's, as you say, sort of not risking anything.
Exactly.
In the pronouncement. And instead, it is the American evangelical groups who end up doing the sort of yeoman's work. We start to get into that yeoman's work and the organizations in Chapter 5, The Nazareth of the Orient, the particular work of the evangelists. And so you identify this balancing act between what you call, quote, the organizational perquisites of moral enterprise, endorsing the state good and evangelical good, promoting modernization, and providing independent funding for their works. So what do you mean by that, and how does that play out? And then similarly, you show that American Christians had a difficult task in balancing the secular nation of modernity and civilization embraced by Japanese elites, and then the religious nature of their own ontologies and practices. So if you could tell us about that as well, that would be great.
So I mentioned before that Christianity in Japan, the ban on Christianity was repealed only in 1873, so only 5 years into the Meiji Restoration. But still, evangelists had to work not just in an environment where Christianity was suddenly permitted, but presumably where antipathy towards Christianity remained. So not just among the populace, but also potentially among the Japanese nation. So these evangelists who come in need to make sure that they are doing work that doesn't step on the government's toes, that doesn't annoy the government, that doesn't piss off the government, that doesn't sound at all seditious or treasonous. But they also had to then present their work as bearing fruit to the boards back in this case, America, or they would be not just deemed as failures, but they'd be pulled back home. Their livelihood would be shut down, to say nothing about the sort of stain that they might feel morally that they had failed to gain souls for Christ. So for these evangelists, you had to make sure that you were towing two party lines, that you were trying to gain converts, but doing it in a way that allowed for Japanese nationhood, that supported the Japanese nation, that didn't undermine any of the teachings of the Japanese nation, including state Shinto. But in order to get money to continue your work, because these missions were not self-supporting, certainly not at this point, you relied on donations abroad. And the best way to garner donations was to present this appeal that you have gotten this many converts already, and the work needs to continue. And in order for it to continue, you need more funds. So this balancing act is extremely tough, particularly in the early days, where you are trying to placate a foreign government in your new home, but also appeal for funds from Americans who don't really care about the sovereignty of the Japanese nation, or, you know, what would step on political toes. They just want to see the bottom line of converts. And what we see for a lot of these missionary encounters is the creation of what becomes known as the pseudo-Christian, which are individuals who believe, as Motoda Sakunoshin, who is the first Japanese Catholic bishop, says, who believe in ethical Christianity, but they don't know anything about spiritual Christianity. That Christianity seems to have a good ethos. There's a lot here that gels with a lot of Japanese beliefs. But if you want to get into the nitty-gritty of Christ and heaven and salvation, that's a little bit beyond the pale. So a lot of these evangelical groups end up sort of giving numbers of pseudo-Christians, individuals who will come to missionary groups or missionaries themselves to learn English or to sort of interface with foreigners or partake in muscular Christianity, sports, and whatnot. And so the pseudo-Christians enable a number of missionaries to present their work as the epitome of the moral enterprise, that the Japanese government can reconsider their hostility to potential cultural imperialism that an evangelical presence might otherwise present, but also could be sort of massaged to appear as if converts were being garnered back to the home board. So this becomes this kind of bind that the missionaries are drawn into. And this kind of ties in with the idea of how do you present yourself as useful to a modernizing, cutting-edge government while trying to preach something that is, you know, a truth beyond time, that that is an ancient truth and goes back, you know, millennia. And so one of the ways that they did this that I sort of mentioned earlier is that evangelists, rather than coming in full steam ahead, preaching the gospel, they sort of couch their work into things that seem useful to the Japanese public and thus the government: linguistic training, education, physical fitness, and then eventually into medical missions and medical work, all of which contribute to a modern populace, assist the nation in its quest to modernize along these Euro-American colonial lines. But it's notable that it takes a while to get the medical mission aspect of the work sort of to be accepted and to be to come to fruition. So Hepburn, who most students of Japanese sort of know offhand, is Dr. James Curtis Hepburn. He's one of the very first Protestant medical missionaries to Japan. He has a very busy dispensary. He becomes head of a Christian medical school in Japan, but he's not known for these things. Instead, he's known for the romanization system of Japanese language. So he's seen as being useful in that way. And the medical stuff, which is where he's really trained, comes later. And we see the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905 as a real turning point, not just for the medical missions, but for Japan's modernizing efforts. That this is the moment where Japan sort of presents itself to the world as like some sort of modern debutante. But it's also the period where Japan's foreign evangelists are able to really prove their utility and their merit to Japan, not just in medical missionary work, but this is when we see this blossoming of ties.
Yeah, and it's after that Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905 that you see particularly the protagonists of chapters 6 and 7, the YMCA and the Salvation Army, becoming sort of core to the story of TB. And so for the purposes of the podcast, I want to kind of smush these two chapters together here, and so that we can talk about them in contrast with each other, because that's really what you're doing in the book. Even though you're examining them separately, you're putting them into this very, you know, clear comparison with each other. Exactly. And so if you could tell us first a little bit about the organizations themselves, and then about their different approaches to medical missionary work and missionary work more generally, if that's appropriate, in Japan during the time of the time period that we're talking about. So how did they frame their work? And I guess what specifically did they do? And what does that all mean in the end for tuberculosis?
Yeah, definitely. So I contrast them, but it's safe to say that they also contrasted themselves. Certainly the Salvation Army worked to contrast itself to the YMCA in Japan. But let me start with the latter. So the YMCA arrives first. Officially, it arrived in Japan in 1889, and it shows up as sort of the official incorporation of separate autochthonous groups that had been, you know, pursuing Christian work individually. The YMCA kind of swallows them up, led by the Americans, to become part of this growing international YMCA organization. And again, because they are there at the behest of the Japanese government, they need to make sure that they toe the party line, but they also are there getting funding from the American board. And one thing they quickly realize, because they generally start off doing, you know, English lessons, is that the army is sort of the heart of the Japanese nation. And the Sino-Japanese War of 1894-95 drives this home, such that, you know, 3 years later, one of the American leaders said, you know, if you capture the Japanese Army for Christ, you capture the entirety of the Japanese nation. And it was the Russo-Japanese War 10 years later where they were able to see this come to fruition. Their medical missionary work, this is their entrance into the medical missionary work, is not so much about curatives or panaceas or even doing sort of the work on the front lines in a medical sense. It's really more about palliative care. And it's about, you know, helping convalescent soldiers sort of kill time while they are in hospital. They come to, you know, speak with them, show them pictures, preach a little bit of gospel. And so when these soldiers are able to return home, the YMCA follows them into the cities. And they're following them as a form of social work, not so much about the social side of it, but about the socializing side. So they continue with lessons. They introduce sports, they build dormitories and gymnasiums, and the YMCA kind of becomes affiliated with fun. And this is fine for the government. The Japanese government appreciates, you know, helping veterans. Certainly, these are our heroes of the Japanese nation. YMCA also, after the Great Kanto earthquake, does the same sort of thing. And this kind of gives them the air of legitimacy. But this medical missionary work is not particularly medical, and it certainly doesn't really focus on tuberculosis, because it's really aiming at the elite of the nation in the cities, and sort of presenting themselves as useful to the elite through the work with these soldiers. The Salvation Army comes in 1895 and immediately sets itself up to try and differentiate itself from the YMCA. It's a difference you can see in nomenclature. The YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association, is a fairly loosely organized fraternal alliance. The Salvation Army presents itself as an army. It prides itself on rigid structure. It prides itself on discipline. It also pursues a native policy, which allows for Japanese involvement. At the start, the native policy is kind of a farce. And that's their term, native policy. They show up, you know, trying to dress as Japanese individuals and live in Japanese houses, but they really just make fools of themselves. But the flip side of the native policy is that they are open to a lot more Japanese involvement at the upper echelon of leadership among the Salvation Army in Japan than the YMCA ever is. In addition, they are very willing to sort of work within the confines of Japanese society to improve it, even if the improvements are, you know, sort of the manifestation that they believe. In addition, they're more open to permitting women to attain high levels of involvement rather than sort of auxiliary groups like the, you know, YWCA. Salvation Army, women can lead and do, at least certainly within the Booth family that founds it. And they're seen as champions of the urban poor. When William Booth starts the Salvation Army in England, it was seen as being beholden to England and particularly London's poor. So just right off the bat, we have this sort of split. And it's not actually just sort of empty words. One of the sort of most famous Salvation Army members and leaders was a man named Yamamura Gunpei, who really kind of invites the Salvation Army to Japan. He is very much in touch with Tokyo's impoverished. He writes a Common People's Gospel, which is meant to be colloquial. It includes furigana, the syllabic transliteration of every kanji. He heads up the Salvation Army periodical in the same way. So right from the get-go, we have these champions of the subaltern urban poor. And they begin to work in labor reform, fire prevention, and then they kind of veer off into working on prostitution and assisting women, particularly in prostitution, leave that life if they choose, because it has been it is in keeping with the government laws that just aren't really publicized. But again, the difference is that they work within sort of Japanese society to improve it. So they're sort of stepping on toes, but they're seen as being very full of conviction, where the YMCA doesn't really piss anybody off, but it's not really doing anything. So there's sort of a begrudging respect that the Salvation Army garners from the government. William Booth, the founder of the army, meets Emperor Meiji in 1907. Emperor Meiji, I think, recalls that that's one of his two most epiphanic meetings of any with any foreigner. I think the other one was Ulysses S. Grant. So take that for what it's worth. But Booth says to the emperor that the Salvation Army should look into a medical facility for indigent tuberculosis patients and donates to that end, which isn't to say that the emperor was unaware of the plight of the tubercular, but this sort of allows that foreign push to come to fruition. So the Salvation Army actually begins building a sanatorium. It's headed by a Japanese doctor, Dr. Matsuda Sanya. Yamamura Gompei's wife assists in pursuing the building materials with the imperial family. It becomes an actual sanatorium. It's joined by a second. The efforts of Dr. Matsuda and his assistant, Dr. Iwasa Rin, a female doctor, really become one of the first true sanatorium in or sanatoria in the country by the end of the Taisho era. The Japanese government had sort of attempted to pursue some. They were limited. They had passed legislation saying that they would. They were supposed to have 9. They had 5. They weren't really functioning. But the government is able to sort of utilize Dr. Masuda's and Dr. Iwasa's Salvation Army sanatoria for their own purposes, which is kind of the whole point of the moral enterprise, really. So we have, on the one hand, the YMCA making soldiers feel better. We have, on the other hand, the Salvation Army, who is sort of working with the more indigent. And I should mention most of the patients at their sanatoria were male, actually. But this differentiation is one that I certainly follow through with, but it's also one that especially the Salvation Army was very keen to make notable early on.
Yeah, and that distinction between different approaches is also the thing that you really follow up on in your final chapter of the body of the book, chapter 8, The Great Gulf Fixed, Rudolf Tuzler and William Voorhees. And so here you're looking at these two evangelists with the very, time appropriate names of Rudolf Bolling Tuzler and William Morel Voorhees. Tuzler, you call him a pragmatist with a deft hand as a moral entrepreneur. Voorhees, who was a one-time TB patient himself, you describe as a savvy businessman. Other than this distinction and the fact that one is an awful speller, the other is an awful poet, who were these guys and when and where did they work in Japan? How do they, as you argue, exemplify the fruition of evangelical moral entrepreneurial efforts?
So because neither end up being beholden to larger organizations like the YMCA or the Salvation Army, they are granted greater freedom. They do not have to take into account these American boards in their sort of moral maneuvering and moral entrepreneurship. And so that certainly helps. But I don't want to take away from the accomplishments of each man individually. Because even beyond that, I think how they went about pursuing medical missionary work and doing so successfully in Japan is quite notable. Tuzler is ostensibly he worked under the kind of broad auspices of the Episcopal Church or the Evangelical Church of America, but he really pursued resources of other missions, relations with Japanese physicians, without any sort of Christian affiliation. It took him a while to kind of grant them equality, but apart from sort of being dedicated to Christ, and certainly he was an evangelist, he was dedicated to his hospital, or the hospital that he becomes sort of synonymous with, which is St. Luke's Hospital in Tokyo. St. Luke's actually predates him. It originally was Tsukiji Hospital, and it was founded in 1874. It had really quite auspicious beginnings, but it ends up falling into kind of disrepute. It's dismissed as a medical mission, as a failure, until Twisler shows up. And when, within a year, less than a year, 6 months, of sort of opening or reopening as St. Luke's in 1901, he had over 300 patients. He was filling 1,500 prescriptions at the affiliated dispensary. And part of this was because he placed the medical aspect of his missionary work in the foreground. Obviously the hospital depended on foreign funds, not just from America, but also from foreign dignitaries and missionaries in Japan. And so he would serve these individuals, the foreign community in Tokyo, and provide them medical care and prescriptions, and then sort of funnel the funds back into the hospital to allow him to provide care for individuals who had kind of fallen through the cracks of previous medical missionary work in Japan. So the domestic urban poor. And he was able to do this really quickly and really quite successfully. He wasn't focused on tuberculosis solely. It really was about just providing medical care to these individuals, whatever they needed. But it caught the attention of the government fairly quickly, including under Okuma, so that they were very open to working with Twisler. And in doing so, it assisted Japan's foreign policy as well, because they could say that, you know, they were working in concert with this American doctor. But at the end of the day, he, you know, was able to take funds from a foreign source and use them to assist his constituents, and to do so utilizing the service of amazing Japanese professionals, Araki Iyo, who headed up the nursing department, her husband, Dr. Kubo. And so Twisler recognized that it was important to serve, obviously, the Japanese, but to do so utilizing Japanese expertise. Boris kind of took that even further, in spite of his god-awful poetry. He was younger. He graduated college in 1904. He had a bright future ahead of him, but he wanted to go to Japan. He was sent originally under the auspices of the YMCA to Hachiman on the shores of Lake Biwa, out in the countryside, to become a high school English teacher. He managed to piss off some of the town's residents by preaching a little bit too vociferously, so he's sort of chased out of that job after 3 years. But he doesn't leave. He stays there and tries to figure out other inroads to supporting himself such that he can continue preaching, because he is getting, you know, converts or at least pseudo Christians. And what he sort of comes up with is architecture. He's kind of an architectural dilettante. And so he starts an architectural firm with a friend and also a Japanese former student. And this firm has a solid basis in evangelical work. It originally begins to build mission offices and churches, and then it branches out into secular buildings, not just in town and the surrounding areas, but across the nation. With the funding from this, he continues to branch out into business. He begins the Omi Sales Company Limited, at a branch of his Omi Mission and Omi Brotherhood, not just for building materials, but he ends up getting the rights, the sole Japanese rights to mentholatum, which is kind of like a Vicks VapoRub and is still manufactured by the company down in Omi Hachiman to this day. If you want a tour of the factory, it's fascinating. And he's able to, with this monopoly on mentholatum and all the money coming in from the architectural firm, he's able to funnel this back into evangelical work. And unlike any of the other sort of evangelists that we meet previously in the book, he recognizes the importance of evangelism in a rural setting rather than in Tokyo or Osaka or any of the major cities. Like Tweisler, he knows that these works should be for Japanese villagers, conducted by Japanese villagers, but this emphasis on rural is new. With this surfeiting of money, he turns his attention around 1905 to tuberculosis. He's not a doctor. He's not even a medical dilettante the way he was with architecture. But when his friend and a convert, Endo Kandyo, passes from tuberculosis, he sort of takes it upon himself to build a sanatorium, which he does in 3 years, the Omi Sanatorium. It's staffed completely by Japanese professionals, all members of Voorhees' mission. And because it's focusing on tuberculosis in the rural communities, it doesn't overlap with any previous foreign evangelical organizations. And it's really seen as quite successful. The mission branches, departments, by 1925 would number, I think, 17. Only the architectural department had a larger staff than the sanatorium. It was conducted on a nonprofit basis. Patients pay just the actual cost of their living. Again, there was no panacea. This is completely palliative care, but it allowed them to quarantine. It allowed them to convalesce in a place that was seen as loving and accepting, or at least as loving and accepting as possible. So without this sort of medical panacea, Voorhees sees a spiritual panacea for tuberculosis.
Yeah, and I think Voorhees is a really good place both for the book and for our interview to wrap up, in the sense that he's, you know, he's a really interesting figure because, as you say, he sort of moves from urban Japan to rural, but also in that sense and sort of more broadly with, you know, he becomes a part of the sort of fabric of society in terms of where the funding has come from, coming from, right? Who he's responsible to, you know, rather than being dependent upon and responsible to the missions back home, the boards back home. And he's working with local staff, and he's, you know, using the profits from his businesses in Japan. He's sort of, you know, he's becoming part of Japanese society, and that sort of is a real interesting contrast to sort of where we start out with, you know, for example, the YMCA and the Salvation Army in the end of the 19th century. So, before I let you go, we do have, in addition to the traditional first question, we all have the, also have the traditional last question, which is, what are you up to now, now that your book is out? What are you researching?
So I have a couple of articles in the works that I've kind of been toying with for a while. One is looking at an individual who was affiliated with the YMCA in Japan in the post-war, Dean Leeper, who perished in a typhoon in 1954, and sort of the relationship between the YMCA and in Japan and the efforts to sort of support his family in the wake of his tragic death. I also sort of have just my own kind of weird projects off on in left field that have nothing to do with Christians in Japan. So I just wrote an article, or just published an article, on Baby-san, who was the protagonist of a series of cartoons from an American GI during the occupation, which present a very, let's say, interesting lens into how American GIs perceived both Japan and Japanese women in the post-war. And I really, really love to contrast that with the 1990s, early 2000s cartoon Charisma Man. That's still in Kuwait. So you heard it here first.
You'll be happy to know I've actually already read your Baby-san article and enjoyed it a lot. I will be looking forward to Charisma Man, you say?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Well, with a title like that, I know. How could it possibly be awful?
Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll be able to have you back on the podcast when you write the definitive volume on Baby-san versus Charisma-san. Charisma Man, excuse me, in the future. But until then, thank you so much for being generous with your time today and joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful.